It's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth. You know, for most of us, our biggest asset is our home. A few of us may have like big stock accounts and may worry about the daily Dow Jones and all that. But for the majority of us, the house is still the way we gain wealth and save wealth in our society. And certainly in Anchorage, there's a very high level of home ownership. So if you don't think about what your house is worth and how it's changing, you're really not thinking much about your finances. And the news right now is good. It seems like the Anchorage market for real estate has been looking up, and people seem to agree that we had a little slump in the real estate market, but it seems to be improving. That's our topic today. Well, why is that? What are the basic underlying conditions? What kinds of decisions should you be making as the real estate market changes? And then we'll also talk a little bit about loans and the commercial real estate later in the show. I've got two guests in the studio. Neil Fried is with the Alaska Department of Labor, and he's sort of our go-to economic guy over the years. Welcome, Neil.
Great to be here, Charles.
And Dan Wolf, Real Estate Professionals, part of Keller Williams. Thanks for being with us, Dan.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, Neil, the Anchorage economy never really got hit like the economy did elsewhere. We had something like 20 years of slow, steady growth, and then we had a little bit of a bump in the road. What is the economic situation right now, and how has it changed over the last few years?
You know, it's sort of fascinating, particularly in relationship to the national experience. Yes, we did have that little bump in 2009 where employment actually dropped a little bit. But by 2010, we had made up all those losses, and we had a record number of jobs again, more than we'd ever have. And that repeated itself in 11, and it's repeating itself this in 2012. So fundamentally, the last two or three years, we've had that slow, steady 1.5% growth in our economy, and it's been pretty broad too. Some sectors did get hit harder than others in the recession, but we sort of sailed through it, unlike most of the rest of the country.
And that's based on oil, we're based on government. Those really didn't go down. If anything, they did well because of high oil taxes. What about real estate? We also, I guess, didn't see the same bubble or the same foreclosure tidal wave they saw elsewhere, right?
Right. I mean, but real estate was affected. I mean, I look at it and I think about three industries that did feel it. One was obviously air cargo because of the world economy. One was the visitor industry because we depend on those visitors from elsewhere in the country. And real estate was a sort of a third one for, I think, some obvious reasons and some less sort of mysterious reasons that it did slow down, sales slowed down, new construction on homes declined actually fairly significantly. But our story is still so much better. I mean, most of the country would have loved to have seen just a sort of a moderate slowdown in actual sales and a small drop in housing prices. In some cases, you'd have to even adjust that for inflation.
Mm-hmm. Dan Wolf, you sell real estate. You're working with people who want to relocate or upgrade their homes all the time. What did you see through this recession period in terms of how the market changed? Was it getting harder to sell houses or taking longer or prices going down?
Yeah, I think the market was really good through 2006. And then about 2007, you kind of felt a little bit of hesitancy. Then when we got down and we could look at the year-end numbers, we'd actually sold about, realtors combined had sold about 200 houses fewer in 2007 than they did in 2006. And then you'd meet with people and they just weren't sure. They would just keep looking, couldn't make a commitment. And I think confidence was starting to wane. So it started about 2007 and continued. Now looking back in the numbers, it looks like 2009 might have actually been the worst. And it really wasn't bad. It wasn't like the sales price dipped dramatically, but there were fewer sales in 2009 compared to 2008.
So that meant if you were putting your house on the market, you had to wait longer, you had to spruce it up more, you had to be a little bit more aggressive in marketing it, that kind of thing?
You know, absolutely. I mean, you're competing with everybody else on the market. So if the inventory is growing, you need to look a little bit better than the next guy and be a little bit better priced. I mean, you're competing with it in your price bracket, price and condition with everybody else. And the average market time was growing through those years from about 2007. Never gross, but it was and it depended a whole bunch on the price that you were in. At the average market price of maybe 3.25, you might be at 90 days, where maybe the year, 2 years before that, it might have been at after 45 days, you were thinking, I wonder what's wrong. Maybe I'm overpriced.
I see. Yeah. So what's happened now? Has that average length on market gone down?
You know, actually, this year we've got some really exciting news. Every year, realtors combined would sell about 200 houses less, and it was year after year. So 2008 was a little bit worse than 2007. 2009 was worse than 2008. Actually, third quarter this year, realtors have sold 150 homes more than they did last year at third quarter, which is about a 10% increase in sales this year. And average market time is starting to edge back a little bit. So we're at maybe average market time is about 45 days right now at the average sales price.
Wow. So that's pretty significant, noticeable change.
It's very noticeable. Absolutely.
So how does that affect the buyer-seller relationship? I mean, does that mean that you have to jump on something when you see it? Does it mean you can price it a little bit higher?
You know, on the average sale price houses, you know, three bedroom, two car garage, good neighborhood and in decent condition. If people go in there and they've got the mindset that they have been looking for a couple of years, kind of keeping an eye out, and they go in there and they want to sleep on it, show their friends, very commonly you run into multiple offer situations. And so it's been a real game changer. And so it's not uncommon to hear of customers that have lost a couple of houses, and all of a sudden now they make a fast offer. They know the game's changed.
Mm-hmm. And that sort of changes the relationship and the whole dynamic between being able to sit back and shop and having to make that quick offer and the seller knowing it, right?
Yeah, of course it depends a little bit on the relationship with the realtor, but if the realtor says, okay, get your pen ready, we're going to look at this house and you got to make an offer. Initially they may feel, wow, you're hard sales, you're a lot of pressure. Uh-huh. And then they miss one and they're like, okay, I get it. Yeah.
Yeah. So does that mean that it's a good time for somebody to think about upgrading, selling, and moving into a bigger, more expensive house? I mean, in terms of the investment, are you better off owning a more expensive house or moving up before, at this point, if we're saying like we're at the beginning of a increase in value, or does it really make any difference to you?
Oh, it absolutely makes a difference. I mean, if you could, right now interest rates are really good. You can get a 30-year fixed rate loan for under 4%, 3.5%. It's credit driven a little bit. You can get a 15-year mortgage for about 2.5%. So, if you're going to live in your house a while, it's 2.5 is better than 5.5.
Yeah.
So you can afford more home right now. And so prices have been flat for, 6-7 years. So you're actually buying in at a very good time. And what happens is, as prices increase, sooner or later, I don't think anybody's gambling that interest rates are going to go lower. They may stay this low, but at some point they're going to go up, and your ability to buy that bigger house as the price goes up and the interest goes up is going to start, it's going to be harder to get.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, this is an interesting topic, and there's lots of questions, and your personal questions about your own situation are always welcome. So join the conversation. We are in Anchorage at 550-8433, 550-8433. If you're calling from outside Anchorage, there's a toll-free number, 888-353-5752. And email is a great way to get on the air, especially if you're at work and you don't want to call and sit on hold. It's hometown@alaskapublic.org. Don't worry, it's okay for a lot of people can listen at work, and it's okay. We're not suggesting any kind of hooky here. So, Neil, you have recently looked at the situation with foreclosures, and I realize that that has been a huge issue in other states and has really devastated communities. And I have this sense that I've seen more. Over the last few years, there had been an increase sort of in for sale signs, but it doesn't seem like we had a real flood of foreclosures here.
No, we didn't. I mean, it's a sort of a fascinating story, especially since Alaska had its time in the foreclosure bright lights in the 80s. You know, basically, the national story is almost a repeat of what happened to us in the 80s. And of course, we didn't join the country in this last one. We did see sort of a doubling in a number of foreclosures in absolute numbers. But when you look at percentages, we are at the very bottom. I mean, we're, I think, 48th in the country for the number of houses and mortgage delinquency. The only other states that have smaller numbers than us are Wyoming and North Dakota. So it's a very different place. But what's sort of fascinating from an economist standpoint is when you look at the statistics from the 80s and our foreclosure during our crash, and you look at the national, it's almost a mirror image.
So how so? In other words, we've stayed steady, or we've had no increase, or?
Well, one way it's interesting because we did go through that trauma, but a long time ago, so it was mm-hmm. very similar. So in that sense, we should be able to understand what's happening in the country better than just about anybody.
Right, and that's around back then. I mean,
right,
the three of
for
us
those
were, but
right.
That was over 20 years ago.
That's even a bone I have to pick. Why haven't people called us and come to Alaska to see what we experienced? Because mm-hmm. I think it would have helped them because, you know, this is a new experience for most places in the country. This has never happened before. And when you're flying blind like that, you know, it really makes you nervous, and you would listen to these people analyzing the national market, and you knew, because we've been through that historically, that they were wrong, but no one asked us to correct that. And I think you could have learned a lot about our past experience, but the nice thing is we got to avoid that experience this last time.
Yeah, well, because our economy didn't collapse, but also I guess we didn't have the bubble preceding the downturn, right?
Right. If you look at this article we wrote, the states that have the biggest foreclosures, you know, 18-19%, the Floridas, the Nevadas, they also had these huge increases in home construction. And it was, when you read about it, it was very similar to what happened to us in the 80s. I mean, the housing market there actually slowed down. It was overbuilt before the recession began. And then you got the double whammy of overconstruction and then the recession. And that's almost exactly what happened to us. But thank God it was a long time ago.
Yeah, well, I remember it. And I was fortunate enough to buy a house right at the end of that time period. With Dan's help, actually.
Yes.
But what it took during that period was to simply slowly working through the inventory, and it took a number of years, right?
That's right. I mean, I think that's the basic, I mean, the solution, or not a solution, but that's basically what's happening. And you're actually beginning to see that happen in a lot of markets. I mean, we aren't the only one that's seen, you know, improved numbers. We're seeing improvement in a lot of places. We just don't have to improve very much. They have a lot of room to catch up.
Right, and there's still a lot of people, it sounds like, who are underwater. They owe more on their mortgage than they have in their house, and so they're trapped in that house until the market substantially improves, and that keeps people from moving and keeps the whole thing from improving.
And in fact, I thought we would get more people moving to Alaska during this last recession because it was so deep. In every recession, we see more people. When the rest of the country's in a recession, we're not, more people move to Alaska, and that happened a little bit, but I thought it would be even more dramatic, and one reason maybe it wasn't because maybe people couldn't move as easily because they had this home.
Right. So as we look at the job outlook in Alaska now, that's something people need to think about when they're planning their finances and when they're deciding whether they want to make an increased investment in real estate. How does it look to you? I mean, are we totally dependent on oil prices staying high, or are we more stable than we were back in the 80s?
Well, our economy is more diverse than we've ever been. I mean, it's gotten a little more diverse every year, but we still have those, you know, oil is still incredibly important. It defines about a third of our economy, and the federal government, you know, that three-legged stool defines about a third, and then there's the rest of the economy. So it's huge. It's still a big, big player in our economy.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned briefly that the new home construction had fallen off substantially. What's happened in the, is that industry showing any signs of life, construction coming back, or is it too early to sort of see movement there?
It looks like there are signs of it coming back. It hasn't come back in a dramatic way because, you know, I think you're beginning to soak up that inventory, which apparently is very low. And when that happens, typically that's the next thing that happens. And these latest numbers are showing some of that, but there's no drama yet out there. Or if there is, we don't know that as economists.
Mm-hmm. One thing, Charles, I think that'll drive new construction a little bit is as the inventory of homes decreases, and actually right now we have somewhere in the neighborhood of 15 or 20% fewer homes on the market at the end of the third quarter of 2012 than we had a year ago in 2011. So as the inventory declines and you hear more people, you know, buying, there's more sales, it'll increase the prices, and that'll actually cause builders to build. Because right now what happens is it's a little bit of a function of financing. Banks are saying, hey, there's foreclosures. Foreclosures are typically priced aggressively. We don't want to compete with the foreclosures, you know, if we have that stuff on our books. And so, you know, I think the new construction will be working its way back.
So in other words, the bank's financing the home builders.
Exactly.
I see.
Right.
So even though you were saying prices hadn't gone down that much, you would think that if the price was still okay, then you could build a new house and make money on it. Is there a different kind of price point for a new house as compared to a house that's being resold and therefore they need to sell it for in order to make their money back?
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of little factors. I mean, the one thing that Anchorage is always faced with is just the availability of building lots. And so you can find a lot, but a lot of them are kind of picked over. You know, they need a lot of sewer, water upgrades, peat removed, gravel brought in. So it's expensive even before you see the house start. And then, all the bones, the steel, the iron, the wood, all that stuff isn't getting any cheaper. So it costs more to have a new house than it does an existing house. Mm-hmm. But we've got an aging inventory of homes. And so not only is inventory down, there really haven't been any significant building since 2006.
I see. So there will be presumably more demand for those people who are looking for that. What about building lots? We hear, we need to build a Kinnickarm Crossing because we're running out of building lots in Anchorage. Do you see a shortage of places to put new homes?
Well, there definitely is, and that's why you see big movements like the gravel pit that became Tulin Park off of Lake Otis and the gravel pit that became West Park in Jewel Lake. Mm-hmm. And those subdivisions are filling up. And when you went over there and looked at it a few years ago, you saw gravel where people our age used to ride motorcycles. I mean, it was a gravel pit. And, and then the builders came in and says, okay, guys, we're not going to call this a gravel pit anymore. We're going to call it West Park.
Yeah.
So you're right. The development that's up in Eagle River and Palmer and, if they build that bridge across the inlet, it's going to open up a lot more inventory for lots.
Mm-hmm. I've noticed more and more, it seems like people are buying small houses in some of the better areas of town, tearing them down and putting up a new fancier, more modern house, especially in the downtown South Addition area.
Right.
So, in terms of turnover of houses, do you see change in the kinds of buyers who come into the market between people relocating? Obviously, there's always some turnover there, and then others who are jumping in because they're thinking, well, we've been in this house long enough, we're making a little bit more money, we can upgrade. Is there a change in the kinds of buyers who are coming to you?
No, it just seems like as employment's been a little bit flat, maybe there's been, the oil companies haven't been pushing, so there's been, it feels to me and in my business that there's been more oil guys leaving, and it's mostly been local people that, they've gotten married, they've had kids, they can finally sell their small house for a little bit bigger. So it's been, for the most part, I think it's been local people more than it's been people transferring new into the area,
mm-hmm.
feels like.
And what is the, what are the main factors that are going into that decision to move up? Do you think wait until you get a raise or I'm just curious. I tend to live in the same house. So does Neil for 30 years or something. How do you see, what's the psychology there? What happens when people make that decision?
Oh, it's a whole cycle of things. It's, people get married, people have kids, there's not enough room, they haven't had a garage, they would love to have a garage. We had a lot of snow last year, and I'm tired of wiping the car off, and so mm-hmm. it's all those kind of things. It's
a little bit of frustration or a little
yeah.
bit of, yeah.
Yeah, somebody goes to the home show and sees a new range, and they would just love a new kitchen, and interest rates are down, and, we're in a 5% loan, and now we can get a 3% loan, and so uh-huh. it's all those factors together.
And so then they have to sell their old house and decide on a price, and how does that conversation usually take place? How does a person, if you're thinking about relocating and you don't really know what your house is worth, how do you go about that?
It's kind of an interesting thing. I mean, it seems like the average homeowner has had company over for dinner and the company says, oh, wow, I really like this neighborhood. And, this house will sell really fast when the subject comes up. A realtor is going to be a little more objective. First off, they've seen other houses, and so they're going to come in. The first thing they're going to do is they're going to look on the street, in the subdivision, in the neighborhood, and then they're going to look at what sold, what would an appraiser say about it, using comparable sales, and then how much are you competing against? If you look at, if the house that the person wants to sell is 3-bedroom, 2-bath, and a carport, you're going to try to compare with that, mm-hmm. and get a feel for how many you're competing with active, and then what an appraiser is going to give you for it. So you're a little more objective as far as determining what the market is mm-hmm. going to be.
Yeah. And then what are you looking for? selling, you know, if you put it on the market, it sells the first 10 seconds, then you maybe were a little low, but you don't want it to sit there for 3 months. I mean, you're trying to find that.
Right.
That's got to be tricky. Huh?
It's actually a fine dance. And that's one thing that a realtor is able to do, is because they're a little bit more objective. A realtor may be able to walk in and say, you know, if you would move this bookcase away from here, move the couch over this way, and, you know, for $1,500, we could replace the countertops, and I think you could get $5,000 more. A realtor can make those kind of calls where a person that lives in it every day, it's convenient for them to have the TV where it's sitting or the couch where it's sitting, but maybe from a perspective of an agent in and out, they may be able to make you more money and sell quicker.
Well, I wonder, you must get into a lot of conversations where you need a lot of tact, where you walk into the house and you think, if these people pick their clothes up off the floor, we could probably sell this house for a bit, huh?
Yeah, it's absolutely true. You do find people that invite you over, and you walk in the door, and you'll think, oh, they had a week's notice that I was coming, and the first thing right when you walk in, they say, we live here, which means we didn't clean up for you.
Yeah, so right.
You do see some stuff. And so then you do have to kind of gingerly walk into the subject of, you know, the way you sell your home is not necessarily the way you live in your home.
Mm-hmm. Or try to get them to move out, right, and sell the home when it's empty. Is that advantageous?
Yeah, in some cases it really is. I mean, some families have the same furniture that they collected from college, and they've got pieces of melamine and press wood, things that is functional, and maybe it'd be better without that stuff.
Uh-huh. So, I got you.
Yeah, sometimes less is more.
Uh-huh. So the show is Hometown Alaska. My name is Charles Wolforth. We're talking about real estate, as you can probably tell. My guests are Dan Wolf, who is Wolf Real Estate Professionals, part of Keller Williams, and Neil Fried, economist with the Alaska Department of Labor, and we welcome your calls. You can get on the show by calling 550-8433 in Anchorage, or from outside of Anchorage, toll-free 888-353-5752. You can also send us an email. Our email address is hometown@alaskapublic.org. And I'd now like to invite another guest to the air. Jeff Stanford is with Alaska USA Mortgage and originates a lot of mortgages and really has his finger on the market for borrowing money. Jeff, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
So we all know that interest rates are very low right now. How low are they? And they seem pretty stable because the Fed has kind of said they're going to keep them low for a long time, right?
It sounds like we're going to be here for a while, yes. I mean, a 30-year fix is right around between 3, 3 1/4, and 15 years or 2.5. So I've never seen money this cheap.
And what about the ability to get a loan? Have the banks loosened up a little bit? I mean, we hear about in other parts of the country, yeah, there's low interest rates, but nobody can qualify. So it's kind of keeps the market from really moving. How has that changed over the last couple of years?
You know, it has. I mean, the pendulum swung way to the right, and it is starting to come back. We are starting to see requirements ease up a little bit. Mortgage insurance has really been a big issue with getting a loan on a purchase. So if you're putting less than 20% down, you have to have mortgage insurance. And the insurance companies have really, they are the ones who have made it very difficult for the borrower, and basically they have increased the credit score requirements. Everybody has to, you know, a certain score to be able to get mortgage insurance, and then the costs of the insurance have also increased. So it's made it more difficult from the borrower, from the standpoint as they do have to have better credit than they have had to in the past. But the documentation's always been the same. We've just years past, we were just very lax on what was required, and now, you know, we need every piece of financial information that, you know, that we request. And so that's, has it become more difficult? Yes and no. I mean, it's, you know, it's things that we really should have asked for from day one forever. But, you know, things just got very loose years ago, and now we're back to solid, safe lending, really.
Right. So how much, if somebody's thinking about buying a home, how much do they need to have down in order to qualify for a loan? If they've got sort of a normal level of credit, not somebody who's been in trouble, but maybe not somebody who's like a millionaire either.
Right. You know, I mean, the Fed has a program, it's called FHA, and it's, the down payment requirement is 3.5%. And that's the lowest down payment program out there, and it's also the most lenient as far as credit scores. And the Fed basically guarantees the mortgage insurance, or they guarantee the loan, so they actually provide the mortgage insurance for those programs. So it's much easier to get loan approval on what they call FHA loans than conventional loans, which are your Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac type loans, which require 5% down, but now you're dealing with a private mortgage insurance company that then has what they call another set of overlays or requirements from the borrower. And again, and they have higher credit score requirements and reserve requirements as far as having, you know, the down payment and closing costs and so forth. So, but for the average borrower, you know, the FHA program is still a great way to go because of the 3.5% down.
So, and is there a limit on how much you can borrow in that program?
There is, yeah. There are limits. You know, it's roughly about $350,000. They keep changing them. It's right around $350,000 for a single family, and then it goes up from there. You can go up to a fourplex actually with the 3.5% down, and the rates today actually on that program are at 3%. So
wow.
So it is. It's a pretty phenomenal program, especially if you're buying like a fourplex. I mean, you know, you can definitely live for free. So.
Incredible.
Occupying one of the roots, right? Yeah. So yeah, it is a nice program, and you know, it sounds like the Feds are going to keep the rates low for, you know, the next year at least. So yeah, it's pretty exciting.
Do you have a feel? I know you've been in this business for a long time, Jeff, and you throughout that period when there was this very loose lending that led to, you know, catastrophe in other parts of the country, but doesn't seem to have hit us as hard. And I wonder if you have a feel for why. We didn't get into the same balloon situation that they did outside. Were lenders here more conservative, or was there some other factor that played into the lending here?
Yeah, there's more of a, I mean, it was the broker mentality, I think, that really got the U.S. economy in trouble. I mean, there were so many more brokers out there that basically could be, you know, Bank of America was probably the worst as far as creating these programs of no income, no verification. I mean, basically, if you had a pulse, you could get a loan. And most of us here in Alaska really didn't participate in those types of loans. So, you know, we were definitely way more conservative here at the credit union. We were way more conservative, but, you know, and even like a Wells Fargo, I mean, everybody was, they were participating, but nowhere near to the level that they were down south, you know, and the builders, of course, you know, you had a lot more contractors down south and more inventory. We just didn't have enough inventory really to get us in trouble like California or Arizona, Nevada.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Dan?
Yeah,
so
we, you know,
yeah.
You know, I was just going to talk a little bit about financing. In the mid-80s, Alaska Housing was a big lender, and Alaska Housing had a program that was called, I think, wasn't it ABE, Alaska's Building Equity?
Mm-hmm.
What it was is you had a normal interest rate, and it was a 30-year amortization loan, but somewhere along the, I think it was the fourth to the ninth year, somewhere along there, every year your payment would go up 5%, and that 5% would pay to principal. And so the theory was you'd have a 30-year loan, but you'd pay it off in, you know, 20 years. And it was a great theory, and so really I think Alaska Housing at that point was it was a good economic plan. I mean, people would have ended up with having a free and clear house in a much shorter period of time and grown equity. Unfortunately, the market went sideways, and a lot of people acted like, holy smokes, my house isn't going up in value like it was, and my payment went up. What's Alaska Housing trying to do? And it caused a lot of people to default because their payment was going up and their house wasn't going up. And I think on the heels of that, after the market got well, a lot of people wanted no part of adjustable rate mortgage. Lenders back in, you know, past that were coming every week. Somebody would come in and say, oh, we have this new program. It's if you can fog a mirror, you can get a loan. You know, and the realtors were like, really? Wow, that's interesting. I mean, educated, smart people are making these loans that seem pretty liberal to me, you know, and because I think we all knew what had happened back in the late 80s. Mm-hmm. So I think in the lower 48 states that did have problems in these big markets where prices were going up, they were getting pretty creative because they were trying to amortize them over 40 years instead of 30 years and use more of the spouse's income. In Alaska, we stuck to 30-year fixed-rate mortgages. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah.
So
we kind of learned our lesson, like Neil was saying earlier. We saw it, and we didn't want to repeat it.
Right.
I think that part of it, and part of it was we didn't have the big housing boom that the markets that are now feeling it the most did. You know, it was just a very different environment. Because there are other states that, you know, sort of mirrored us even even during this last recession. So, you know, I think it's important to look at, you know, certain states, state by state. But, yeah, it was a very different environment. You know, we lost almost half of our lending institutions during that period that was tied to this construction. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, I mean, it was, you know, people do remember that, although right. that memory is slowly fading. Because I was just talking to a group this morning. I looked out and at least half the audience may not have been alive then. I'm going, maybe I'm boring them here, you know?
Well, I guess they call that creative destruction of capitalism, right? When the lenders who are go crazy, go out of business, then the ones who are left are maybe more conservative. I wanted to ask you, Jeff Stanford from Alaska, USA, about refinancing. I know there's rules of thumb in, about when to refinance. If you can go down 1%, then you should do it if you are going to be in your house for X number of years. Can you share with us, for people who are thinking about refinancing, kind of where the break even is for refinancing right now?
Yeah, you bet. I mean, you know, 1% is definitely the minimum. I'm more conservative. You know, I'd say 1.5. But, you know, some people at 1%, I guess it also depends on what their remaining balance or what they owe. You know, somebody who's got a $600,000 loan, you know, 1% saves them $400 a month. So, you know, it the payback is much quicker than somebody who has a $100,000 loan, and, you know, and they're only saving 1%, and then they're only saving, you know, 40, 50 bucks a month, and it doesn't pencil. The payback is much longer.
Because of those closing costs for closing the loan.
Correct, yeah. I mean, unfortunately, we used to be able to do drive-by appraisals, and you know, there has been some ratcheting on values just because we haven't seen values appreciate like we used to. So, you know, the costs really have not gone down. And, you know, the federal government right now, with, you know, because they do own Fannie and Freddie, which are our big investors, you know, they keep raising the costs of doing business. That means the fees that borrowers are going to have to pay. And after January 1, they're going up again. And so, you know, again, I'm sorry to sway, but yeah, at least 1 to 1.5%, and it also depends on the type of loan they have, whether they have a VA loan or a conventional or an FHA. VA being because there's no appraisal required. VA makes it the easiest for the veteran to refinance.
In terms of those costs you have to come up with.
Correct. And, you know, basically the VA really doesn't care there's no appraisal required, so equity doesn't come into play. Where if you have somebody who has a house up in Prominence Point that bought maybe a couple of years ago and they've seen no appreciation and maybe even some depreciation of their value, and an appraisal's done, all of a sudden they find out that they actually owe more on the house than what it's worth. And in that type of situation, you know, there's really no way to refinance it. So,
I got you. Is anybody utilizing any of these programs for write-downs of loans, or has that just simply not been necessary here in Alaska?
Well, I mean, we have what's called the HARP loan, but then there's some of these programs that the federal government has come up with that nobody in Alaska is participating in, and I know we aren't. I don't think anybody in Alaska, to be honest with you. Again, we really weren't hit like Arizona or California with values where they went down 30% or 40%.
Yeah, just not necessary, right?
So correct, yeah. I mean, so there are some programs out there, but nowhere near what's available down south.
All right. Well, thank you. That was Jeff Stanford with Alaska USA Mortgage. Thanks for being with us, Jeff.
My pleasure. Thank
you. All right. We're going to go to a break here on Hometown Alaska. We'll be back in just a minute and give out the phone numbers and talk more about real estate. Thanks for being with us. It's Hometown Alaska.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska on KSKA Anchorage. You can subscribe to free podcasts of Hometown Alaska on our website, alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA FM 91.1.
It's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth. Our topic today is the real estate market in Anchorage. In the studio, I have an economist, Neil Fried, from the Alaska Department of Labor, and a real estate agent, Dan Wolf from Keller Williams. And we'd like to get your calls if you have any questions about what's happening with the real estate market, selling your house, or anything along those lines. The phone number here is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Outside Anchorage, it's 888-353-5752. Email is hometown@alaskapublic.org. And we welcome your questions and comments. We're on today live from 2 to 3. The show will be rebroadcast tonight at 8. Normally, the rebroadcast would be at 7, but because of the presidential debates, everything's being moved back an hour. And, of course, if you're listening to the rebroadcast, we won't be taking any questions because we won't be here. We'll all be at home. Neil, I think that the factors that drive the Alaska economy are pretty unique compared to other places. It used to be that we had an economy that was based on boom and bust, the most recent resource discovery or the most recent change in the inputs would cause a huge surge of growth and then a collapse. That hasn't been the case for quite a long time. And now we have an economy that seems to just have these inputs that are steady state. And while the rest of the country has a business cycle, we don't seem to have one here anymore. Is that true, or how do you?
Well, that has been true for about the past 25 years. That may not be true for the next 25 years. I mean, that's sort of the way it has worked. I mean, I think we have to be careful. Just because it hasn't happened up until now, it won't. You know, Alaska really, since statehood, has only had sort of one bust, and most other years were periods of growth. Now, this decade has been the slowest period of growth we've ever experienced. Even in the 80s, when you include the 80s, the boom and the bust, we actually grew more during that decade than we have this most recent decade. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's hard to say, but our economy is fundamentally different than the national economy. There are a few other states that look a little bit more alike. Hudson had a similar experience, but we have a sort of an odd mixture of you know, how many states have a big oil sector, a big fishing sector, and a big federal sector? I mean, you know, kind of we're sort of a unique player there. But there was, I mean, the difference in our economy, even though back in the 60s and 70s, we were probably even more different than the rest of the country than we are today. We have a much more consumer-driven economy now, I think, in Alaska than we did, because a lot of our growth in the last 20 years has been in that service sector.
Do you, we were talking a few years ago about the Ted Stevens effect, and that when Senator Ted Stevens left office, we'd have all this loss of economic activity, and people sort of had maybe a little bit of a Chicken Little reaction to it. But we don't seem to have seen a Ted Stevens effect. I mean, as you said, we had a 0.5% decline in growth for 1 year, and then we're sort of back to. So what happened there? Why didn't we see more impact from the departure of Ted Stevens?
Well, I think it's to some extent too early to tell. We have to remember that we had these very large stimulus package that came on because of the national recession, not because of what happened here. We obviously benefited from that, but I think when we look forward for the next 4 or 5 years, there, you know, like federal spending is very likely to be ratcheted down nationally, I mean, all over the country, and since it's very important to us, you know, more important to us than most places, we probably will feel some of that. The question is how much, and that isn't a question I can answer, but it certainly is not, we don't expect that to be a growth sector for the next 3 or 4 years.
Right. Military and then also civilian federal spending, I think, adds up to something like 40% of our basic economy, or at least
it's
more
about,
than 35?
About 35, a little more than a third of federal spending. Federal spending represents almost about a third of our employment and income in this state, which is, mm-hmm. you know, pretty large.
And then after that would be the oil industry. And
oil
and state
and everything
spending
else, right, that through the oil revenues would be another third. So that's two-thirds. So you can watch those pretty closely, and whatever assumptions you want to make about those will help you decide what you think is going to happen in the next 3 or 4 or 5 years. And they're very hard to tell. The oil one's much harder to tell. There's a lot more volatility or potential volatility out there. The federal government, the trajectory is, we know what direction is likely to be, and we just don't know where. How much?
Right. Dan, we were talking a little bit before the show that it's pretty hard to trace what's happening in real estate directly to what's happening in the economy, because as we said, there was a lag in the real estate market in terms of houses staying on the market longer and construction, new home construction slowing down. But then Neil is telling us, well, the sort of basic economy didn't change that much. And so what do you attribute that slowdown to? Is it just a mood or maybe feedback from the national economy?
You know, we all know, all Alaskans know that we're a little bit maybe counter-cyclical to the United States, but we still watch TV at night, and we have families that live in the lower 48 and places. And so, you know, a couple would think, oh, I'm going to sell my house or I'm going to buy a house. And maybe their folks would say, boy, I'd think about it. And they'd talk to their friends at work, and you'd hear somebody say, yeah, maybe I'm worried that the other foot hasn't dropped yet. And so there was kind of a conservatism. And so it really wasn't anything that you could pin to numbers. And so, you know, the realtors would be saying, boy, this is a great buy. Interest rates have never been better. And people would be like, I'm not so sure. You know? Mm-hmm, and so it just takes one bad story to kind of be a check and balance, I think.
Yeah. And then it's sort of self-fulfilling. When you see a lot of for sale signs in the neighborhood, then you start thinking, yeah, maybe things are bad after all.
Right. Sometimes you'll see, you know, two signs up in the, somebody will say, and they could be completely unrelated, and somebody will drive up and see two signs and think, what's wrong with this neighborhood?
Right.
You know, and it just happens to be two people that just coincidentally happen to be going somewhere at the same time.
Yeah. Well, here's a listener question. Do you have any tips for selecting a realtor? And this is one of those decisions that it feels like it's free, right? Because you don't pay up front, but you are, in fact, paying a commission, or the seller's paying a commission. And it does make a difference as to who you select in terms of the effectiveness. How do you figure out who the right one is?
Yeah, you know, from a buyer standpoint, it's just, you know, it's maybe a personality and a work ethic. You know, you have somebody that works hard, and, you know, I can't look at houses until I get off work at night, or my Saturdays are open. Are you available for that? So from a buyer's perspective, it's just take time, get out and get houses. And then when I find one that looks right, it's, you know, is this a good price? You know, and a lot of that's going to be a factor of just seeing enough houses.
Mm-hmm.
From a seller standpoint, you are paying a commission when you hire a realtor, and so there's a little bit more to it there. It's factors like what are you going to do for me, discussing things like advertising, open housing, marketing, staging your house, making it ready. Are you available? How can I get in touch with you? This is where I want to be communicated. Is that okay with you? And so there's a little more from a seller's perspective, because you're trying, every seller I know has got a couple of things. How fast will it sell, and how much am I going to get?
You know? Right, right.
So, and what are you going to do for me?
Do they ask for references often?
Absolutely do. Yeah, yeah. You know, I think, you know, kind of in the industry, I've noticed that people will buy from somebody that just happens to be at an open house and they like the house. So you have a little bit lower standard. It seems like there's kind of a 80-20 rule where maybe 20% of the real estate is really handled by, or I'm sorry, 80% of the sales are handled by about 20% of the people. And it's usually a group of people that have been around for a long period of time. I mean, you all have realtors that come to mind when you think of realtors, and it's typically not the guy that got his license last year. It's typically someone that's been around.
Word of mouth.
10, 15, 20 years.
Yeah, so, yeah. So in terms of the commission, it's paid by the seller. And so the agent is really working for the seller. And then the person that is representing the buyer, is there a conflict of interest there, or how is that handled?
Well, it's actually kind of come full circle. Back in the early 80s, we never even had to talk about who's representing who. And then I guess initially it was assumed that everybody was representing the seller. And so you had to be kind of careful what you said to the realtor. Then it came full circle, and now buyer's agents can be paid by the sellers but can represent the buyer. And so when a buyer and seller sit down with an agent's required to disclose an agency relationship. So if you're on both sides of the transaction, it's considered neutral, or you have to tell the buyer, I'm representing the seller. That doesn't mean that you can't do a good job and have a fiduciary responsibility. I mean, there's still things that you have to do to the consumer, but you have to make it real clear of where your loyalties are and how you're getting paid.
So people should just be aware of it.
Right.
So we've been talking with Dan Wolf here about residential real estate, but of course that's not the whole market. There's also commercial real estate, office buildings, retail spaces, and so on. And so we have another guest with us now, Mike James of Bond Stevens and Johnson, to talk about what's happening in that market, which is quite different at times from residential real estate. Mike, thanks for being with us.
Oh, you bet. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
So it sounds like a residential market is kind of turning up, and the time that properties are staying on the market is getting shorter. What's happening in the commercial sector? Are you seeing the same kind of improvement?
You know, on the commercial end, you've got really kind of a couple different areas here, too. You've got industrial, you've got office, and you've got retail. What you see, everything kind of... Everything was a little bit stagnant there for a little bit when it came with the recession that we had here a little bit. People didn't quite know what was going on, and some people, of course, wanted to do things, but maybe the banks were very flexible with their money prior to. So things had tightened up, and it became a little bit more difficult. And what you've seen now in the last couple of years is that the sky hasn't fallen. We're all still here, and you still need to operate your business. And what's nice is that rates have actually come down over the last couple of years as well. So it's made it a little bit easier for people to be able to go through and afford that debt service each month. What you've seen here on the good example, if you look at the office buildings in our skyline here, in the last couple of years, you've had a couple of new buildings come up. Now, when they go through and they build an office prior to this, we had a very tight Class A office space market. You know, people say, oh, these buildings have been standing around here, or they're, you know, half vacant. Well, they're slowly getting filled up, and you try and go through and pre-lease these before you build them. But you're going to have some of these here that they just take time to go through and do, and any developer is going to be looking for the long term, not what's just happening today and tomorrow.
So is that, I mean, I particularly drive by a building that's at the corner of C Street and Northern Lights on a daily basis, and it's a beautiful building, and it had the Denali pipeline on the top floor for a while, and it just seems to be empty, and I just wonder, well, how in the heck is that happening? How does it happen that a big building like that doesn't have anybody in it? Is it something about the leasing costs, or what's, or is it because the overall market is slow? What's your feeling about something like that?
Well, a lot of those, when you look at these Class A buildings too, it's not the local mom and pop business that comes in here that that's operating. A lot of times you'll see the national type tenants that come in that can afford these lease rates, and what you're seeing are between $3 to $3.25 a square foot for this new Class A. Existing Class A, like the Calais buildings, you're seeing about $250, $265. So there's a bit of a spread there, and to go through on these new ones, like you're talking about this one here on C Street, Northern Lights, and Benson, it's one where they went through, the developer built it, and I don't know if you've seen it lately, but the entire ground floor, there's work going on there right now, so you don't see it happen right away, but two floors, my partner and I actually in that building just leased out here this last spring.
Okay.
So in the construction, when you look at it too, somebody comes in a new building, you have a shell, you can't just sign the lease today and walk in tomorrow. You're going to have a design, you're going to have construction, permitting. You know, that could take you 90 days just to get all that done before you're ready to even occupy it, if you're lucky.
Now, what about retail space? There's been this huge expansion of retail space at the Tocatinu Center with the theaters and all that. And does that kind of empty out the sort of the older space? And do people move out there? I sometimes wonder how much retail space can we actually support in Anchorage? It seems like there's an awful lot.
Well, if you look at that retail, there on the, you've got South Anchorage that's done very well, and North Anchorage has been kind of neglected. When they went through and put in with Tocatinu, you had retailers that may have a South Anchorage location that want a North Anchorage to go through to balance their what they've got here in the market. And if you look at Tocatinu there, those rents right there are also very expensive, just like these Class A buildings with this new construction. And it's national retailers coming in there, the PetSmart, the Lowe's, the Kohl's. You don't have really a whole lot of small local retailers that have gone in over there just because it's so expensive. But you're going through and you're seeing Sam's Club, as you may well know, is going to be relocating. They're currently over on Bregaw by Northway Mall, Pendland Parkway there. They'll have they'll be going through with a new spot there. Now that their old building will become vacant, and that was is on the market right now. I was trying to think as far as my understanding, Old Navy will be going in there, so you might see a vacancy in the Old Navy over at Glen Square. But you know, look at that Glen Square. Tocotinu Commons has really put a lot of pressure on that Glen Square property because it's just not as ideally located when you look at all the remaining co-tenants that you have over with Tocotinu.
Yeah, and that one never seemed like it ever leased up in the first place. It was kind of not real successful.
It's challenged.
Yeah. So do you see, it sounds like maybe to a greater extent than we might see in the residential, you must see quite a bit of correlation between the national economy and what's happening in commercial real estate locally, because so many of these renters and users of space are big national firms that if they run into trouble nationally, obviously they're not going to expand here. Is that true?
You know, our hardest part is trying to tell them we're still a part of the United States.
Right.
You know, to come up into the Alaska market, you know, once you're here, it's a lot easier to try and help them find another location to expand the market they're in right now. You know, we go down every year to conventions, my partner and I, as far as trying to sell on Alaska and why you should come up here. We have, on average, a higher net worth, disposable income here. But for them, a lot of it has to do with them trying to figure out their shipping. And the things, their cost to do work up here, the expense of construction is about another 20-25% more than what they have down south, which affects the lease rates. And then also coming through and just overall management. You know, it's difficult if you might have somebody that does the Northwest, Washington, Oregon, Idaho, and they have one store in Alaska. Typically when they come in here, they're going to want to have a couple of different stores.
Mm-hmm. Hey, one last question. You mentioned these big box stores that then move and there's an empty big box somewhere. Do those ever get reused or do we, it seems like most of those companies would build a custom building that's just the way they want it. And once they move out, it would be hard to find another tenant for that.
You know, two good examples are over at the same site. One right now is the Borders building.
Mm-hmm.
Most retailers want to have it all on one floor. It's very difficult to get your customer to go up to a second level.
Right.
And it's difficult to, as far as management, watching the customers, being able to service them on two different floors. It just takes more people. So that's the Borders building. And the second part of that question is what you've seen with Michael's, the Sam's Club, the Petco, Sportsman's Warehouse. That was all the former Kmart Supercenter.
Right.
And they essentially cut off the front, the nose of the building there, so it wasn't very long like a tunnel. They went through and cut the front off, so they had multi-tenanted this building, and that's been a development success for us.
Okay. Well, great. I want to thank you for being with us. Mike James of Bond Stevens & Johnson, thanks very much for your time.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Neil, I just wanted to touch with ask you a question following up what he was saying. Our local economy changed a bit when these big chains came in, didn't it? Our wages, our average wages went down when national retailers took over. And my sense is that we lost a lot of local retailers when the big chains took over. I don't know if that's true, but that's sort of my perception. Could you address that?
Well, it's hard to answer to some degree, but it is an interesting thing. We have to remember that. Well, here's an interesting statistic that relates back to that big box store invasion. Is Anchorage has had no growth in retail employment for 10 years, which is kind of surprising given the fact that we do have this new Tocotinu Center and other new retail. But we had the huge growth in the 90s. That's when it all happened. And that did have a depressing effect on wage, just because retail was now absorbing a bigger part of our labor force. Well, that's didn't happen this last decade. So I think we've absorbed that. Did we lose a lot of local? We lost some local retailers. We lost some national retailers as well. Montgomery Ward's and a number of Pay and Save, Pay and Back, others. You know, so that's harder to tell. I mean, I think it was just a stage that we were going through that maybe came a little later than elsewhere, but what's interesting is we seem to have absorbed most of that, and as a result, that hasn't grown at all, and hasn't had that depressing effect on wages this last decade.
Mm-hmm. Here's an email question, which I think he was directing it to Neil, but I think I'd like both of you to answer it. Up until 2006 or 2007, the Alaska MLS would release a data document each spring that would provide detailed numbers on house sales in Anchorage for the prior year. It was well over 40 pages of just data tables. MLS stopped distributing this in recent years. Instead, they put out a substitute summary with much less granularity. My question is for Neil. Is there a place where the public can access these sales summaries or anything similar? And I guess this is focused on, you know, getting informed about what your own house is worth and what's happening out there. Is there a source for information of that kind?
Well, we are a contract for Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. It's called Anchorage or Alaska Indicators, and you can go onto the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation's website and find all kinds of data. You can find it on our website as well, a fair amount of housing data. But as far as the MLS data, I think Dan probably can you know, talk about that more than I do, because I don't.
That MLS data is just for agents, right?
Yeah, it's proprietary. And
and multiple listing service. It's where you take your listings and put them in with everybody else's. So.
Right, and you have an agreement that you're going to operate under a certain playing rules and share data. I think the only site I know that would have MLS data, and it's actually compiled by MLS, is called, it's the public site of MLS, it's called AlaskaRealEstate.com.
Yeah, and we actually have that linked on our website at AlaskaPublic.org.
There is a statistic page on it. I'm not familiar with what this person is asking for, but there is pretty good data on there.
Is that a kind of a good way to get a feel for the market, to go on that website and just sort of shop around and see what looks similar to what you're into?
On the AlaskaRealEstate.com, mm-hmm. you're limited to what's on the market. So you're comparing your house to other houses. Yeah, you know, you have a little bit of problem being objective. What you really don't know is what they sell for. That's a realtor thing. A lot of times you'll go to somebody's house and they'll have picked up a flyer at the end of the street and it didn't really sell for that.
Right. Yeah. It's always a little bit different. Yeah, that's the image and the reality. Yeah. Well, we're out of time, but it's been a fun hour, and I've really learned a lot. So I want to thank my guests, Neil Fried, who's an economist with the Alaska Department of Labor, Dan Wolf of Wolf Real Estate Professionals, part of Keller Williams, Jeff Stanford was with us earlier from Alaska USA Mortgage, and Mike James of Bond Stevens & Johnson. And you can find out information about all our guests and other links at alaskapublic.org. Just click on today's show there on the main page. Next week on Hometown Alaska, join host Kathleen McCoy to talk about the Alaska Native perspective on the Constitutional Convention ballot initiative. We're going to be voting, believe it or not, on whether we're going to have another Constitutional Convention. Hometown Alaska is on the web at alaskapublic.org. You can also join us on Facebook at Alaska Public. Pat Yak is the Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Spack is our web editor and audio engineer. Thanks for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.